Hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, January 30th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is author John McNally. John is the author of three novels, After the Workshop, The Book of Ralph, and America's Report Card, and two short story collections, Troublemakers and Ghosts of Chicago. He is also the author of nonfiction books, The Creative Writer's Survival Guide, Advice from an Unrepentant Novelist, and Vivid and Continuous, Essays and Exercise for Writing Fiction, which is really going to be the focus of our talk today, both published by the University of Iowa Press. He has edited, co-edited, or guest-edited seven anthologies. His work has appeared in over 100 publications, including The Washington Post, The Sun, San Francisco Chronicle, and Virginia Quarterly Review. As a screenwriter, he has a script in development, and it's with the producer of Winter's Bone. He's an associate professor of English at Wake Forest University and on the core faculty of Pacific University's Low Residency MFA program. He's been on the show before, I think, for After the Workshop and his Creative Writer's Survival Guide, and I'm happy to have him back on with his new book, Vivid and Continuous. Hi, John.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me back.
I'm so happy you could be back, and I want you to talk about how you are so prolific while teaching and having lots of students. How do you do this? Really?
I don't think of myself as prolific, actually.
You
know. I just, I work a little bit every day, and it adds up. I mean, that's really kind of the secret to it, I guess. But with some of the books, like Vivid and Continuous, those were books that are, that was a book that was in progress for a number of years because it was I had been writing these essays kind of piecemeal. And the same is true with short story collections, that in between working on novels or while working on novels, I'll write a short story, and eventually it adds up. And so there's I think there's the illusion of being prolific in some ways.
Well, you know, I don't think it's an illusion, but I understand we are our own hardest critics, our own worst critics, actually. And but, you know, you said a little bit every day and it adds up. Talk about that. I mean, will you get it in before you go to your job, before you deal with students' work, or will you get the other stuff out of the way before you get to the writing?
Yeah, I'm completely useless at night, so I have to do it in the morning. And I try to do it while, and I talk about this a little bit in Vivid and Continuous, but I just in terms of process, most writers I talk to seem to write either very early in the morning or very late at night, and I think it's that idea of trying to tap into your that kind of dream state, you know, where you're kind of sleepy. It's easier to tap into the unconscious mind, and so the writing, in some ways, I think, seems, you know, less calculated, or it's more likely to surprise you. And so I tend to write not long after I wake up in the morning, because the longer I'm awake, then the more aware I am of all the things I have to do for the day and bills I have to pay and everything else. And so, and I think when I was younger, I used to kind of berate myself for, you know, not putting in a certain number of hours, and I would try to work all day, and I don't do that now. I put in just a little bit every day, and certainly as projects come closer to being completed, then I start spending a lot more time on them, and then I become kind of obsessive, but that may be for a month or two.
I seem to ask this to all of the guests who write fiction and nonfiction, so my listeners are probably getting really, really tired of this question. I hope not. I hope somebody's hearing it for the first time. But because you work in fiction and nonfiction, because you write novels, you write narratives, you write essays, you write articles, you do, you know, screenplays, how do you sort the ideas or the content into the various contexts? You know, I mean, like, how do you know? I mean, some things are obvious. You know, pieces on writing are going to be in a writing book. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But other things, you know, ideas that perhaps become essays or short stories or novels, how does that happen for you? Is it the scope of the idea, or is it something that just won't leave you alone, or what is it?
That's a great question. I think for novels, I feel like the novels, there's a kind of gestation period just in terms of thinking about them before actually writing them. And so I feel like I don't wake up one day and have an idea and then start writing the novel the next day. It's usually something that's stuck with me for a number of years, you know, and I don't necessarily think that, I don't realize that until I'm done with the project, and I think, when did I actually start this? And sometimes it was 5 or 6 years before I actually put pen to paper. Whereas a short story is a little bit different. I may wake up with an idea and then just pursue it and see what happens. So there's not that same, you know, there's not that same, I think, time investment in terms of, I mean, short stories sometimes take me forever to write, but there's not that same time investment in terms of thinking about, mulling over, and, you know, trying to decide if this is something I want to spend, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 years on. Mm-hmm. Screenplays are different. I mean, they're just, the ideas tend to be a little bit more high concept. They feel like movies. I mean, I guess it's an intuitive sense of what something feels like too. So there's certain narratives that just, when I think of it, in a kind of three act structure. I can see it as a film, and a novel in some ways can be, since a novel has so much more of an internal life than a screenplay. Those ideas that I think are a little bit more complicated in terms of being able to do a lot more with backstory and with the internal life of the character seems more novelistic to me.
It's interesting. And then will you jump from one project to another if one, you know, is happening more for you on a certain day, or do you need to get through one to get to the other, and, you know, one at a time?
I've always worked on a lot of projects at once. This is actually the first time in my, probably in the last 15, 16 years, where I have nothing on my plate right now. Mm-hmm. I have some short stories I'm working on. I've got some ideas for novels, but I don't know what to pursue. I have an idea for a screenplay. But normally I'm working on a lot of different things at once, and I think what I do is I tend to work on something until I just, either I don't know what else to do with it, or I'm stuck, or I'm bored with it at the moment. And, you know, and I think a lot of writers are like this too. As soon as you start working on one thing, something else starts calling to you. Mm-hmm, it's just to kind of pull you away. I try to resist that as long as I can, as long as the one project I'm working on is compelling enough. But if it's not, then I move on to the next project. But it's a little, there are times though where it's been a little maddening when you have, you know, a screenplay, a novel, a nonfiction book, and a lot of short stories all in kind of a wretched state, you know, so, or needing a lot of work.
That's a good way of describing it, a wretched state. You know.
That's the title of my next novel.
I was going to say, that's the title of something. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest today is author John McNally, and his most current work is Vivid and Continuous. Talk about the writing of this book and the publishing of this book.
Well, I had done the other book with Iowa, Creative Writer Survival Guide, which was more of a book about being a writer. And what I tried to do in that book was answer every question I've ever been asked about being a writer, and then try to figure out a way to organize it logically. But this is sort of the craft side of this of that book, and so this is focused on. How I like to think of it is, it's kind of like, I try to explore what I think of as kind of the side streets of fiction writing. You know, there's so many craft books out there, books that do excellent jobs talking about point of view or characterization or setting. And what I found was that at a certain point, I had a kind of collection of essays that were things that I talk a lot about in class, but that I can't find a lot about in textbooks. So, you know, things like the narrator's likability, or I have a chapter on minor characters, or immediacy, which is something I talk a lot about in class, or the use of pop culture in fiction. And some of these grew out of talks I've given at conferences, and some are have grown out of talks that I give to my class, and some were had been commissioned by textbooks. Once I began looking at all of them, I began realizing that these were, you know, these were kind of odd little essays of things that I was addressing that I don't see addressed that often. And so so then it became compelling to me to put it together. And since I'd worked with Iowa, I went to Holly Carver, who was then the publisher, who I'd worked with on three previous books, and pitched it to her, and she took it to the editorial board, and they agreed to do it. So the one thing I have to say is that it was much harder to fill it out after that. it's always fun to have the idea and to have, you know, half a book done, but then it became a much more difficult book to write, because I had to go back and look at the old essays and tighten those up, and also try to think of who my reader is in a way that's different than if I'm giving a talk at a conference full of writers.
Mm-hmm. And so you said you went to the editor. So this would, the university presses wouldn't be presses that you would need an agent for, sounds like, because of the advance size or what?
Yeah. excuse me. With university presses, you can approach them oftentimes with, sometimes with a proposal, sometimes with a completed manuscript, but you don't typically need an agent. I'm sure they get some work that comes in from agents, but agents typically don't want to necessarily represent things that are also being sold to university presses, because there's not, you know, there may be a tiny advance or there may be no advance, and you're just kind of selling, the money that's earned is based mostly just on the sales.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much smaller than at the commercial level.
I love what university presses are doing, though, and I'm so glad they exist, because there's so many books coming out that are not with big traditional publishers that are giving big advances, but books that are so worthy and important. And without university presses, well, I guess there's always self-publishing, but I love that university presses are picking those up.
Yeah, I think probably half of my books have been with the university presses, and part of it's trying to figure out is it a good fit for a university press, or is it more of a commercial book? And I felt like this book, it was a companion to the other book, and I thought, I love what Iowa does with their books, and they're gorgeous books, and the people there have been great to work with, and so I really wanted to do this one, and Holly was stepping down from being the publisher, and I really wanted to work with her on one more book too. So I developed a relationship with her that's a little bit harder to develop sometimes with, I think, commercial publishing, because there's so much turnover sometimes too.
Yeah.
So I feel like I have this little home at University of Iowa Press for at least four books.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm also curious in terms of, teaching writing. You have been an instructor for a long time. How do you teach writing?
Oh, that's a great question. I ask myself that at the beginning of every semester. The very first day, the first couple of classes, I feel so overwhelmed by how much I want to begin introducing to students what sorts of things, and but you also have to be careful of not overwhelming them. And so, for example, this semester I just walked into my beginning class and started off before we did introductions or anything, and just read a short story to them, a short story by Dan Shaun, and then we began talking about it. But I'm very craft oriented in terms of this. I want the class to have a common vocabulary. I want them to be able to look at, kind of cause and effect. It's if you do this, if you choose this point of view, this is what's likely to happen, as opposed to choosing this other point of view. And what will work best with this particular narrator. So it's a lot of questions like that. So we when we look at stories. Another story that we looked at, which is one of my favorites, Joyce Carol Oates's Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been?
Mm-hmm.
And really kind of looking at that, we looked at point of view last week in that. So it's kind of breaking the story down and kind of looking at those choices. But it's very tricky, because I tell them, you know, I don't want them to necessarily think of those things when they sit down to write. I mean, you know, so you want, at least I want my students to internalize those things, but not let those things get in the way in their of their intuitive sense of how to write the story. And so the analogy I always give them is of playing pool, which I did a lot in grad school. But, you know, I would go to one bar and I would work very consciously on bank shots or on putting, you know, a certain spin on the cue ball, or and I would do this for hours and hours and hours, and then with the hope that one day then I would walk into a bar to play competitively and just, you know, be able to run the table without thinking about those things, just kind of being in your zone. So I'm constantly going back and forth in class of looking very consciously at craft, but then trying to also not hinder the, you know, the writer's intuitive sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Wow. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm on with John McNally. His book is Vivid and Continuous. I like this book so much. I only received it the other day, as you know, and so I've been spending time with it. I love the references to authors and short stories that you include in it to illustrate your point and or your points. And I love your voice here. Your voice sounds like, you know, you talking to you, and has that humor, that wacky sense of humor that comes through when you talk to you. Talk about voice, and, you know, did you always have it? Did you connect with the page quickly? Did you work to sound like yourself and to not sound like your idols or your, you know, people you were learning from, working with?
It was very slow for me to I think figure out what my voice would be. When I first began taking courses, creative writing courses, as an undergrad, Raymond Carver, of course, was mm-hmm. all the rage, and so I began writing lots and lots of stories that sounded to me like Raymond Carver, but were clearly not of that caliber. all writers, I think, you know, my students do this all the time, go through an imitative phase. I have lots of writers, a lot of students now who you can kind of see who their idols are, where, you know, I'll read a short story and it reads like Cormac McCarthy, or, that seems to be who I'm reading a lot of now in terms of imitative student work. And I think that's a necessary process. And the thing, you know, for me, I think somebody told me early on, it's like, well, you know, go in the, you know, read writers who are unlike Raymond Carver, or read writers who are, you know, just read a lot of different kinds of voices, because then the more voices that fill my head, the more likely it is that, you know, eventually I'll get out of the imitative phase and begin writing, you know, the way that, you know, whatever seems sort of natural for me. And it really wasn't until I began writing stories that ended up turning into the Book of Ralph, that I felt that I actually found a voice. And part of that may have been, I was writing about where I, you know, the area where I grew up and the time that I grew up, through a character who was somewhat like me, but not entirely like me. And it just seemed natural in terms of the sorts of observations, the things that this character would see and look at. And so it's still very crafted in terms of going back and revising and, you know, looking at how the sentences work and the syntax and all of that. But it was just, it took a long time. I mean, it probably took a good, I don't know, I want to say 12 years of writing before I got into that mode that I felt more comfortable. I still have a problem. I still have a hard time with essays. I'm happy that you're enjoying the book, because I there's a tendency to want to try to be very formal in an essay, and I try to resist and think of, well, how would I say this? How would, you know, what's my sensibility? What's my worldview?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that you say it took, I think, 12 years, because you know, writers, and I don't know if it's because publishing these days is so very easy to do, whether it's, you know, self-publishing or creating an ebook or blogging or what have you, but it seems that writers are a bit more impatient these days to you know, nail their voice right away, to know what they're writing about, to have their stories be perfect from the start, to not have to go through a dozen or more rewrites on a piece. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think I was an impatient writer. The first book I wrote was when I was in grade school, and I began sending it around, querying New York publishers. So by the time I started high school, I'd been rejected by all of New York publishing. So if that's not the definition of impatience, I'm not sure what would be. And I look back on stories I wrote in college, my first creative writing classes, and at the top I have listed the magazines that I would want to send them to, and it would begin with The Atlantic, The New Yorker, et cetera. So I'm not sure, at least for me, that's not necessarily new. But maybe, you know, I think to speak to your point, I think maybe the idea of being able to have, I mean, we live in a world with Facebook and with blogging and Tumblr and everything else, that there is this, you write it and it's instantly out there. And so maybe that's tapping in somehow to that sense of, you know, wanting kind of instant gratification with the fiction you write. You know, the thing I've learned is that I'm much, much more patient now with the things I write, and I don't feel, you know, I don't feel like I have to get something out there right away. You know, I wait until it's done, and sometimes it may be years for a short story, even.
Now, could that be because you're already published? I mean, if you were coming up now, and, you know, there's all these ways to publish without having to wait for a publisher, what do you think? I mean, would you be more impatient?
Well, no, I think that's absolutely true. It's because I have published, and because I, you know, I see that I don't have to. It's not going to do anything for me or my career to it's like I have one more publication, and so to me it's about the work. But certainly when I first began sending things out, I wanted that sense of that affirmation that you get from somebody outside, and I felt like that was important, and it kind of kept me going. And you know, I don't show my first 7 or 8 short story publications to anybody now, but I think they were necessary to keep me going. I think the thing is, you know, I think it's important though to identify the sorts of places you want to publish. You know, are they publishing work by writers you admire? Are they publishing work you admire? And that's really still my criteria. It's not, I don't look at it. I'm not very careerist, and maybe that's been to my detriment in that way. I mean, I'll publish now with very, very small places and some larger places, but I try to fit the work with the place in terms of its sensibility, and also in terms of a magazine that I would like to be in, and who, you know, that I would be proud to have my story in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that I try to impart to younger writers, is that, you know, just publishing for the sake of publishing seems kind of hollow to me. And, you know, at least try to find venues where you would be very, you know, you would be proud of it.
Sure. Well, I'm so glad we have you for the next half. All of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with John McNally, and he'll be reading from his new book. So don't go anywhere. Stay with us, okay?
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one more bed in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Riders on Writing
every Wednesday morning
at 9 a.m.
with Miss Barbara
and Miss Murray.
Did we say it was Wednesday?
Wednesday!
At 9?
Wednesday!
In the morning?
Wednesday!
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I've been here with author John McNally. And just so you know, if you just tuned in, this show will be podcast, hopefully within the next week. If you go to my website, penonfire.com, it'll be there. I think you can sign up for an e-list or something where you'll get notified when I post the show. Or you can go to writersonwriting.blogspot.com, which is where we keep the archive of podcast shows, and it will be there as well. That's all that's there on that blog is just shows. Pen on Fire has some other stuff going on. What else? The Pen on Fire Writers Speaker Series will start up again in March, and we'll have novelist Seth MacFarland and Joanne Mapson. And perhaps another novelist in April is literary agent Betsy Amster, along with some other agents. And in May is T. Jefferson Parker. He always returns with his new novels, and he's another quite prolific author that I love and always love to talk to. And you can find out about those events by going to penonfire.com as well, and going to, I think the tab is Writer Salon or Speaker Series or something. Something or other, I should know, right? Anyway, let's bring John back on. Hello there.
Hello.
Why don't we begin with you talking, or you reading from Vivid and Continuous. Would you do that?
Sure. I'll read a little section from the chapter on humor. And I should say some of the chapters are very, a little bit more technical in terms of my approach to talking about craft, and some are just a little lighter and a little maybe more philosophical.
Okay.
So that's this particular chapter I would put in that category. Humor. I'll admit it, my tastes are lowbrow. I'm an academic only because I happen to teach at a university. At an on-campus interview several years ago, I was asked about the humor that runs through my fiction and who my influences were. While I stared blankly ahead, a few of the professors interviewing me offered up a plethora of literary examples. I suppose I could have agreed with them, and then we all could have moved ahead without the awkward silence, but I didn't. If I'd had any chance at the job, I blew it right there. The thing is, no one they mentioned had been an influence. It was, however, a question worth thinking about, even if it meant standing there and looking like an idiot. To my detriment, I'd rather look like an idiot than say something I don't really believe, hence years of unemployment. I hadn't ever given any serious thought to my humor influences before that interview, but the answer, the truth, is that I read virtually nothing the first 18 years of my life. Instead, I watched and listened to endless comedy in one form or another. I bought 8mm movies of Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy. Every Saturday at 2:30, I watched Evan and Costello. I watched the Marx Brothers whenever they were on, or the Three Stooges, or even second-rate comedy teams like the Ritz Brothers. I bought albums with vaudeville routines on them, typed up the routines and memorized them. I practiced them in front of my dog. I listened to cassettes of old radio shows with Jack Benny and Edgar Bergen. In the seventh grade, I started writing a book about old-time comedians. I finished it at the end of eighth grade, 200 pages of prose typed on a cast-iron Royal typewriter. Girls scribbled in my autograph book, "Remember me when you're famous." Oh yes, I thought, I will. I wrote to every publisher in New York. No one wanted to see it. But it wasn't just the old-time comedians that interested me. I listened to Cheech and Chong, to George Carlin, to Bill Cosby, to Richard Pryor. I started watching Saturday Night Live, beginning with their second show. I saw Steve Martin in concert back when he could pack the largest amphitheater in Chicago. He wore an arrow through his head and sang King Tut. I stole his routine and won second place in the eighth grade talent contest. Disco Dancers won first. I savored everything that was funny and or supposed to be funny. I bought a lot of books. The idea of books interested me, especially since I had written one. But I read next to nothing, unless it was a book about comedians. How could I have not internalized all of this comedy? How could I have not picked up a thing or two about the ways in which humor works? Many years later, and only after writing several short stories featuring a narrator named Hank, a good kid in eighth grade, and his troublemaking friend Ralph, who had failed both the third and fifth grades, did I realize that they were a comedy team, a straight man and a comic, and the rhythms of their dialogue resembled the rhythms of a vaudeville team. Even the dynamic of their relationship, a con artist and a naive, looked an awful lot like the template for, say, Abbott and Costello. And so does my contention that there's much to be learned in the so-called low art. But it's also my contention that one sense of humor is innate, and that while you may be able to teach the mechanics of comic writing, you can't conjure up the soul of a comic out of thin air. It's either in the DNA or it isn't. A few semesters ago, I showed a Saturday Night Live clip to my fiction writing class, the point of which is now lost on me. Perhaps I had nothing prepared for the day. I don't remember. Anyway, I showed the clip, and everyone laughed, but one young woman laughed nervously, and when we began discussing the clip, she admitted that she didn't see what was funny about it. Before anyone could say anything, she added that she didn't understand any of the humor on Saturday Night Live. This wasn't a comment on the show's declining quality or the fact that Lorne Michaels no longer seems to know when to end the skit. No, she was admitting that all humor of this variety escaped her. All of it. This, I should note, was a student with a 4.0. But over the two semesters that she took classes with me, I saw time and again the fear in her eyes when classmates started to laugh at one thing or another, and then she would join in uncertainly, only to say, "What? What?" Furthermore, I tend to believe, and I should note, I have no proof for anything I say, I'm an English professor after all, that the comic sensibility you're born with is the same one you'll have for the rest of your life. That's not to say that it won't become more sophisticated or more complex. It will. And it's not to say that you won't be able to appreciate other types of humor. You will. But the sorts of humor that most appeal to you at 2 and 3 years old will appeal to you at 43. As much as I admire Dorothy Parker, I would still rather watch Moe poke Curly in the eyes than read Ms. Parker's work. In fact, I never tire of watching Moe poke Curly in the eyes. Consider Moe, if you will, that ball of fury, that tightly wound epitome of pure rage. We may not want to admit it, but Moe is us, really. He's us every time we talk to a stupid boss. He's us every time one of our colleagues does something that makes us look bad. He's us every time someone cuts us off when we're driving. The difference is this. We do nothing. At most, we flip someone the bird when the person isn't looking. But Moe, he does what all of us wish to do. He pokes his cohorts in the eyes. He hits them with a sledgehammer. He picks up a cheese grater and gives them a good scrape across the face. Everything within his reach is a weapon, a flower pot, a bandsaw, a vice grip. He's us without restraint. Imagine a world in which we could clonk our boss over the head without consequence. I loved Mo when I was three, but in the intervening years, the weight of Mo has accumulated, and I love him anew for the larger things Mo represents, the metaphor of Mo, and for that, he's funnier than he's ever been. But I digress. So I'll stop there.
That's great. That's great stuff. You've been listening to John McNally read from Vivid and Continuous. I want to say there's so many writing books, and I mean my book Pen on Fire is one of those, and so I think since writing that, most writing books that get thrown at my door by UPS just they don't speak to me. This one covers so many topics and goes into such depth that I find helpful, and so thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I really like what your section on narrators too, and I wonder if you would speak a little bit about the likable, unlikable narrator, which is one that I particularly like in fiction because he or she is more complex, but also as a writer, I think difficult to write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always talk to my students about this, which is that I tend to break narrators down into the category of the likable narrator, which is the narrator who you would enjoy hanging out with in real life as well as on the page,
mm-hmm.
and then the unlikable narrator, who's the narrator who you may not like on the page, or you may have, maybe a slightly dubious narrator, but is who you wouldn't necessarily want to hang out with, I'm sorry, in real life, but who on the page is very compelling,
mm-hmm.
and for some reason. And then there's the unlikable, which is the hardest of all to try to pull off, which is the narrator you resist on the page as well as somebody who you would resist in real life. That's always fascinated me, and I feel like, most books probably fall in that middle category, or books I enjoy at least tend to fall in that middle category, characters who I'm not sure I'd want to hang around with the character, but there's something redemptive about them. They're either funny or there's something about the language that's aesthetically pleasing, or there's something vulnerable about the character. And so, but they're flawed and they're, and that in and of itself can be a hook of sorts. So that's something that we, especially when we start workshopping stories, we talk, I bring up on occasion, to kind of tease out a conversation
mm-hmm.
with my students.
Mm, it's interesting. And when you start writing, when you're working on, say, a story, or maybe you're starting a novel without really knowing what you're writing, but this is probably applies more to short fiction. Should you know what genre your story will fall in before you begin? I mean, if you're a literary writer, should you write what you think is going to be a literary short story? Or, do you need to know?
I think less so now in some ways. I mean, maybe for book marketing, for novels, there's still, I think that, there's still a desire to I think, pigeonhole books into certain categories for marketing purposes, but you see a lot less of that now. I mean, you see a lot of supposed literary writers writing genre sorts of books. I feel as though that there's a door that's been opened in the past 10 years that is blurring a lot of those lines. I just wrote a short story for a tribute anthology. It's a book called Shadow Show, and it's a tribute to Ray Bradbury. And it's a combination of writers such as Margaret Atwood, Joe Hill, Harlan Ellison, Dave Eggers has a story in there. And I was asked to contribute a story to the book. And the editors tried to find writers who had been influenced by Bradbury, and Bradbury was certainly somebody who I read when I was younger, and who one of the few books that I did read, and so I gravitated towards that for a number of years, and I think what's interesting is that writing that story kind of opened up for me that flexibility within, like, writing. I'm suddenly writing a bunch of other stories in that vein that are, I don't know exactly what they are. They, some have a fantastical element to them. Some are just kind of you know, strange and off kilter. And there's a kind of freedom to that that I really like, that I enjoy, because it kind of taps into why I began writing in the first place, which was, you know, to entertain myself and entertain other people without having to think of all these sort of, you know, like, will this sell? Will this be marketable? All of those sorts of things.
Right. And, I mean, that brings up another point. That is, how much should you keep the marketplace out of your office? Should you just forget about it when you're writing? Should you, you know, in the back of your mind be thinking, you know, this would work in this journal, or this is like this story by this writer?
Well, for short stories, I don't think of it at all. I write the story and then try to find the market for it afterwards. I think for a novel, just because of the time investment, it's something that I do think about marketability a little bit more. Just in terms of, you know, I don't want to spend 5 years of my life writing a book that is not in any way remotely marketable. it does come into play, I think, for me a little bit more, but you know, but I don't know, you know, in some ways I'm the books of mine that have sold the fastest in terms of being able to you know, get a publisher right away have been books that I really wrote. Like, The Book of Ralph is an example. I wrote that book thinking nobody was actually going to publish that book. It was just an odd book. It was, and I'd been working on a book that was much more, you know, quote-unquote commercial, and that the agent that I had at that time had wanted me to pursue, and then I kind of broke things off with that particular agent for a number of reasons, but, and I just pursued writing The Book of Ralph, and just because that was the book I wanted to write, even if nobody published it. And I got a new agent, and I think the book sold in about 3 or 4 days, something like that. That hasn't happened since, but it did teach me a lesson of, you know, at least writing the book I want to write. Without writing to the market. So I guess those are two separate issues, which is like keeping the market maybe somewhat in the back of your mind, but at the same time not writing to the market, which I think can be detrimental.
What about writing for the group? Or you have a chapter in here about your ideal reader, which is really interesting. But I think about this a lot, you know. It's like, excuse me, in writing workshops, often there's a page limit, and often there's a certain, you know, the majority of writers are writing similar works. And you know, you can easily get swayed by the group you're in, rather than your own vision, or at least the vision you had when you began. Or I suppose, you know, if you're thinking about marketing, you're going to be thinking a certain way. I mean, what about that? What about writing for a particular reader, or writing for the group?
I think at a certain point that can be problematic. I mean, I do feel, I talk about this a little bit, I think, in the Creative Writer Survival Guide, where, you know, I'm an advocate of workshops. I think that they're, you know, it's a great way to kind of speed up the process in terms of getting to a certain point of, you know, things that you might have learned on your own or figured out on your own, you know, with the guidance of the workshop in some ways. It just speeds it up. It gets you through, you know, like whether it's technical issues having to do with point of view or something else, it's like you can, it saves you time. But I think there's a certain point at which if you're writing to that group, just because I see it so often that this happens, that I'm not sure that that's the audience that the piece that a person's working on should be the intended audience in some way. And so if you're constantly responding to what they're saying, which is sometimes very contradictory or not part of, you know, what your own impulse would be as a writer to take, you know, where you'd want to take your work, then I think it becomes somewhat of a problem. I mean, I think it's good to have trusted readers, but I think that's a little bit different than writing to kind of a larger workshop. I'm not sure if I'm answering
that
question.
Yeah, you are. You are, and you must see this a lot because you teach in MFA programs and, you know, just dealing with, you know, how each student, each participant influences the others with, you know, again, that group mentality, which can be a wonderful thing or detrimental.
Yeah, and, you know, every work in... I mean, I guess because I've seen this so often, even sending, you know, having an agent send manuscripts out to editors, where editors will, you know, sometimes say very contradictory sorts of things when they reject the manuscript. And so that's where you really have to rely on your own intuition at a certain point, you know, I think. And, you know, I think you either need to, you know, succeed or fail on your own intuition at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and certainly not everything I write, I've had many books rejected and not published too. So, but I think that's part of the process.
Rejection is an interesting one. You know, it's once a writer is published, I think everyone around them thinks they will never receive a rejection again.
That's absolutely false, except for maybe three people. So, John Updike, who is no longer with us, but I mean. There are those few lucky people who everything they write will be published in the New Yorker, but that's just, you know, I think maybe if you have a certain number of sales with your book or something, that maybe, you know, you're kind of golden in terms of whatever you do, but the vast majority of people I know, that's just not the case. And I think it's, even now, it's tougher. It's because, I think publishers are kind of scrambling to try to figure out how to adapt to all the changes that are happening. And so there's a little more nervousness, I think, sometimes in terms of what to take on.
You know, you're active on Facebook, and I have to know how, and I ask this to everybody because I'm just so curious with social media, if you find it really helpful, and do you think it brings readers? Do you think it just is a nice place to spend time when you need to, you know, get out of your head? Do you, you know, how does social media sort of work in terms of your writing life and you know, helping that or hindering it, I suppose, but mostly we're talking about helping.
I was afraid you were going to ask me.
Sorry.
I have a very vexed relationship with Facebook. There are aspects of it that I like, but I've also pulled the plug on it for a long period of time. And the thing I've always found, I actually paid attention once when I went off of Facebook for an extended period, which is that I was writing a lot more. And I was a lot more productive, and my mind was clearer. I'm nervous of things that are distractions, and, you know, just kind of wary of them. I'm not sure, maybe it does generate sales. I'm not that active in terms of, like, I don't send out many friend requests, so, you know, most of the friends that I have are people who've either sent me friend requests or people I just know.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really speak to that part of it, but there's also something, you know, it's nice to be able to, I think for me it works well oftentimes, for example, if I'm teaching and I think, you know, oh, can somebody recommend a story that has this in it? And I'll get, you know, 30 responses right away. As far as a distraction, I find it to be a huge distraction to writing, personally, for me. And I'm not sure that it generates many sales. Back with MySpace, I really built up an audience, like a lot of people, where I tried to target. You know, it was easier in some ways where I could kind of target. Like, these are the sorts of people who might buy my book or who might show up at my readings or whatever. And then I did a book tour, kind of longish book tour for one of my books, and two people showed up total. So I just thought of like how many hours I put in to MySpace.
Right.
Of course,
right,
then of course MySpace, nobody's on MySpace now. It's kind of like, it's like a Mega Man on MySpace now.
Yeah, it's interesting how these things sort of come and go. You wonder what's going to happen with Facebook or Twitter, and you know, there's Pinterest, there's, you know, so many. You know, you just kind of wonder. But
yeah, and I tend to, and I go back and forth too, where I will unplug from Facebook and then just work on a manual typewriter. so I mean, I have this kind of strong anti-technology streak in me too.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, we are at the end of our time, and I wonder, you know, in closing, if you can offer perhaps any advice you've received along the way that stuck with you and that you remember and that perhaps is still helpful.
Well, this may not be quite the advice that you're looking for. When I was, I spent a year in Los Angeles doing screenplays as part of this fellowship with Paramount Pictures, and so we had constant access to screenwriters who would come in and directors and whatnot. And so this one screenwriter, Academy Award winning screenwriter, came in and he said, "My biggest piece of advice to you is keep your overhead down."
Uh-huh.
And it's actually, you know, I think about that now. And I mean, on the one hand, it seemed kind of, it had nothing to do with writing on the one hand, but on the other hand, it had everything to do with writing.
Right.
Which is this idea that, you know, it's easy to kind of, you know, put yourself in debt, or if you're younger, to kind of take out lots of student loans to go to school. And certainly, it's played a huge part in terms of, you know, how much freedom do I have, you know, if I'm burdened with an enormous amount of debt.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways that's kind of, as I said, it's probably not quite the advice that...
It's good advice. Keep your overhead low. I mean, I totally tell people that all the time. It's like, keep it down.
Well, it's like, you know, if you have a writing life, you want the flexibility to be able to do certain things and have the time to write. And time, I guess the thing is that time is your most valuable commodity,
right,
you know, for a writer. And if you don't have that, then it's very hard to be productive. And it's hard to carve out a life as a writer unless you're independently wealthy.
Yes, totally. I totally agree with you. And I thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, really, it's been great. Thank you so much. Okay. That was John McNally. His book is Vivid and Continuous, and so many other books, and you can find them online. And I can't say enough about him, can I? So we're at the end of our time, though, and you can find out more by visiting penonfire.com. And my book is Pen on Fire. And until next week, thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.